The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, November 2019, Volume 20, Number 10, and this is the first of five installments of the November issue. On this month's cover, Oprah wears a black form-fitting button-front low V-neck sweater dress. Her hair is long and smooth, and she wears polished, natural golden and black stone teardrop-shaped earrings. This month's headlines are A Cure for Loneliness, My All-Time Favorite Turkey Recipes, and I'm Sharing One of the Most Joyful Experiences of My Life. And this month, we have a double cover. So when you open up the first one, you have a second one. And on this one, Oprah is sitting with a white background on a white stool, wearing black exercise gear, a black stretchy top, and black stretchy running pants with wide white racer stripe down the side. And she's wearing some high top sneakers that are silver with black sides and star shapes, varying sizes of star shapes have been punched out of them. And she's also wearing big gold earrings, hoop earrings. And the quote on the second cover is, Thanksgiving is about love, pure and simple. Kick back, count your blessings, reach out to someone who could use a friend, and by all means, have some fun. Oprah. And then behind the scenes, Oprah is having her hair styled by Nicole Mangrum, and Derek Rutledge is working on her makeup, and she's sitting back laughing, and she's wearing a white shirt dress. Oprah's fave new fashion find, Bacall's cotton poplin shirt dress, $214 at bacall.com. And the heading under behind the scenes is Night and Day. This month, it's a tale of two covers as Oprah effortlessly switches up her style from sophisticated to casually cool. The theme of versatility was in the air as Whitney Houston's rendition of I'm Every Woman just happened to be playing on set. Turns out it was music to Oprah's ears. She said, "This used to be my show's theme song." We have a couple of snapshots here of the collection of makeup on the dressing room table. And they include a roundup of complexion enhancers, including Olay Regenerous Retinol 24 Night Serum and Moisturizer, $29 each at Olay.com, which work overnight to give next day hydration while improving skin's texture and tone. And then below that, there's a selection of shades for lips, eyes, and nails. And there's a picture, a casual picture of Oprah, along with creative director Adam Glassman, and Oprah saying, "Anyone mind if I wear this on the plane home?" That's the black athletic pants and top. And then we have a selection of five different pairs of sneakers. Fancy footwork is the heading. Treat yourself to a shoe shine. Whether you're in athleisure like Oprah, jeans or a dress, a snazzy pair of sneaks add some sparkle to your day. And they do all sparkle. The first two pairs are kind of flat sneakers with the white band, you know, right at the sole. And the first pair is from VJ. They're $150 and go to VJ-store.com. And they're a gold pebble leather look with just kind of a hint of maybe a bright pink. And then they have white lace-ups. The other pair is from CV's. Go to CV's.com. They're $98. And these are that rose pink sequined. So they're a bit like a pair of low-top Converses in look. Now, we have got a couple of high-fashion pairs, and they have the super chunky soles. The first pair is Michael Kors, and that's $170 at MichaelKors.com. They are black with gold leather trim. So they've got a gold band around the toe and a little, you know, kind of geometric shaped piece around the heel and then at the laces. And the sole is actually in two chunky platform parts, and it is layered black, white, and black. And then the next pair is from Stella McCartney, and they are silver and white with just this massive kind of platform sole. And the silver is in different textures, from smooth to pebbled to highly pebbled. And then the white looks a lot like a pair of running shoes. And they have Velcro straps, and they are $685. And then to finish it off, from Converse.com, we have a pair of high tops that are in kind of a leather look, a pewter pebbled leather look with black laces. And again, $70 at Converse.com. And now let's go to Here We Go. And this is a picture of Oprah. She's standing kind of with her back to us. She's looking over her right shoulder. White background. She's in that same slinky black sweater dress and some really snazzy black high heels with lots of kind of stripes and lace at the ankle. And she's holding a big letter I, which is the first letter of the article. It's tough to imagine anything more heavenly than the scent of a home-cooked meal. This month, I'm sharing not only what I believe to be the planet's most luscious turkey recipe, but also a squash pie made with enough cardamom and tahini to leave you asking, "Pumpkin who?" Thanksgiving is a day for togetherness, but lately a lot of people seem to be having a hard time making real and lasting connections. Loneliness has become a serious issue for many. The good news is there are steps every single one of us can take to combat isolation and touch another life. And see what I mean later in the magazine on page 120. Speaking of touching lives, Prince's music touched everyone. He was outrageously talented and wickedly funny, and he was gone too soon. But on page 108, we've got some of the wonderful photos and stories he left behind. I think of it as a final gift. As for me, well, I only want to see you having a joyous holiday, reaching out to a few kindred spirits and laughing in the purple rain. Oprah. And now we'll move over to what is a relatively new page in each month, and it's called The Way In, your take on topics we're covering this month. So white background, as most of the things in the Oprah magazine are, and we're looking down, we have a picture of a pumpkin pie, one of those cute dogs that has all those wrinkles, short-haired dog. I think they're Shar Pei's. And then we've got a deep pink sparkly dress, and then there's a picture of a woman sitting in hiking gear looking out, really, I think it's over a rocky ledge with lots of trees in the background, and then there's a picture of Prince singing at a microphone. So the first question, if you had to choose between pumpkin pie and stuffing, 41% say sugar, spice, pumpkin pie is so nice. 59% say stuff me with stuffing. Next question, have you ever had Botox or fillers? Now this is the Shar Pei with all of its wrinkles. 16% say, of course, I'll try anything once. 84% say, not for me, I like my lines. And then the question with the sparkly dress, what's your go-to party outfit? 30% say, hello, statement-making sparkle. 70% say, can't go wrong with an LBD, little black dress. The next question, looking at the woman out in the mountains, how often do you feel lonely? 59% say, luckily, not very. 41% say, more often than I'd like. And finally, with the picture of Prince, which Prince song? 66% say Purple Rain. 34% say Kiss. And starting off the first installment each month, we look at from the reading room 10 titles to pick up now. And the first item is Agent Running in the Field by John Le Carre. The espionage master's thrilling latest brings intelligence expert Nat out of semi-retirement to lead a motley group of British spies who stumble upon a covert Russian operation against the West. But it's Nat's Trump-hating badminton partner, Ed, who may be the mission's unwitting sleeper cell. The second title to pick up now, Celestial Bodies by Joka Alharthi. In this 2019 International Booker Prize-winning novel, a trio of Amani sisters, a repressed seamstress, an aspiring intellectual, and a dewy-eyed idealist, grapple with fates forged by the clash between their strict patriarchal upbringing and modernity. The third title, Royal Holiday by Jasmine Guillory. From a reigning queen of contemporary romance comes a wondrous amour between Vivian, a 54-year-old black woman who's overdue for vacation and spending Christmas in England with her daughter, the Duchess's personal stylist, and Malcolm, Her Majesty's private secretary, a.k.a. Hot Chocolate. Number four on the list, Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl by Jeannie Vanasco. When Vanasco was 19, a close friend sexually assaulted her. 14 years later, she tracked him down to get some answers as to why. Here she spins that episode into a cuttingly funny meditation on her own pain in the context of hashtag MeToo. Fifth title, Edison by Edmund Morris. The celebrated biographer who died in May leaves us his last work, an ingenious and revealing look at the complex man whose inventions changed the world, even though there's no such thing in Edison's own words as, quote, an ideal being brain-born, everything comes from the outside, end of quote. And the sixth title, Homework by Julie Andrews. The legendary star of Mary Poppins, The Sound of Music, and Victor Victoria reflects on her momentous career and complex marriage to director Blake Edwards, sharing tidbits about her friendship with Walt Disney, how she got over losing My Fair Lady to Audrey Hepburn, and the difficulty of being both a devoted mother and a working actor. The seventh title, Ordinary Girls by Yakira Diaz. This hard-hitting memoir in essays adeptly captures how the wounds of youth can remain long into adulthood. The author survived a foul-mouthed, chain-smoking mother described as, quote, small but scared of nothing, end of quote, while trying to avoid becoming her Lothario father, a, quote, keeper of secrets, teller of tales, end of quote, who gave her, and now readers, the gift of words. The eighth title, A Pilgrimage to Eternity by Timothy Egan. The New York Times columnist and disillusioned Catholic wrestles with his crisis of faith while walking the Via Francigena, a 1,200-mile medieval path from Canterbury to the Vatican. Interspersing the historical with the personal, Egan's chronicle of the journey leads to his epiphany that, quote, there is no way. The way is made by walking, end of quote. The ninth title, Areas by Sharon Olds. The Pulitzer Prize-winning poet's incendiary 12th collection lingers on the dissonance between our public and private selves, quote, actual as a small mammal in the woods with a speaking countenance, end of quote. And the tenth and final title to pick up now, Curious Toys by Elizabeth Hand. After a 14-year-old tomboy pen, drug runner for a carnival, cross-dresser, and daughter of a fortune teller, discovers a murder at an amusement park, she tries to crack the case in this atmospheric, gender-bending mystery set in 1915 Chicago. And now let's move to the special feature section of the magazine. And this month, in honor of this being, well, the National Month of Eating and Food, The creative folks at Oprah have given us a great picture intro, and it's a cutting board. It looks like it might be some really pale marble, and there's a dish towel and a bread knife. And in the middle of the page is a loaf of bread that's been baked in this circle, the Oprah O, which is wide on the sides and really skinny on the top and bottom. And it's a very crusty kind of natural-looking bread, and it has had leaf patterns sort of cut or etched out on the fat parts of the O on the side, and it looks like maybe they have a glaze that's made them brown a little darker. And then this is surrounded by other crusty and rustic breads. Some have been sliced, and some look like they've just come out of the oven. And we'll start out with one of the long articles, Suffering in Silence. A staggering number of Americans are profoundly lonely, enduring a sense of isolation that can endanger their health and, in severe cases, their lives. O went searching for answers to two not-so-simple questions. Why is this happening, and what can be done? Loneliness is perhaps the greatest of human aches. It thwarts our fundamental urge for connection. Even as infants, we look into the eyes of our parents to seek the reassurance of their mirroring gaze. In our early lives, the security of our attachments with our caregivers helps shape the degree of confidence with which we'll move through the world. And the unique gift of our species, the beauty and complexity of language, is most priceless because it allows us to share each other's delights, burdens, and amazements. The philosopher Michel de Montaigne wrote more than 400 years ago, quote, "There can be no pleasure to me without communication. There is not so much as a sprightly thought comes into my mind that it does not grieve me to have produced alone, and that I have no one to communicate it to." End of quote. We know intuitively that when we're starved for company, we feel weak and withered, that we're healthier when we're among those we care about. Yet according to one 2018 survey of 20,000 American adults, nearly half report they sometimes or always feel the effects of loneliness. Perhaps modern life brings death by a thousand cuts. The busier and the more stressed we are, the more we may withdraw, never realizing how our self-imposed exile is draining our vitality. The even more alarming news is that this silent plague afflicts not only the soul but the body. Research gives a chilling new meaning to the phrase dying of loneliness. Loneliness has been linked to cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, diminished immunity, and early mortality. What's more, the epidemic may actually be contagious, spreading like the common cold. One lonely friend increases our chance of loneliness by 52%. However, loneliness can be cured the way we would cure any other disease, with awareness and action. In the pages that follow, experts bring the issue out of the darkness, weighing in on the factors that lead us to this public health crisis and offering solutions we can put in place together. The most important of these, of course, is to administer liberal doses of nature's antidote to loneliness, love. And this article, this entire feature section on loneliness, is made up of lots of small contributions. Under the heading, All the Lonely People, Where Do They All Come From? The first one is, We Value Achievement More Than Attachment. Vivek Murthy, MD, former U.S. Surgeon General and author of the forthcoming book, Together, says, In my conversations with people around the country, I realized that no matter their health challenges, their underlying stories were often about loneliness and emotional pain. Our connections are the foundation for everything. To repair that foundation, we need to focus on people and not allow the pursuit of work and wealth to undermine that. My parents came here from India because America is a place of opportunity where someone like me, a poor farmer's grandson, can become Surgeon General. That's the power of this country. But we've lost sight of a thing that my grandfather used to say, quote, We are responsible for each other, end of quote. We're also bombarded with cultural messages that we're not enough, which may lead us to believe we don't deserve connection. The key is to know that we are worthy. And from Sherry Turkle, PhD, psychologist, MIT professor, and author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, we have, we're left too much to our own devices. Turkle says, quote, we're living in bubbles, going online to stream entertainment, buy books, order dinner. Technology tempts us with convenience and makes us forget what we know about life. It's nice to sit opposite somebody in a restaurant. It's nice to take your kid to a movie. It's nice to go with a friend to a bookstore. These things are part of the joy of human community. Just because tech can do something doesn't mean we should let it, end of quote. And next, under the heading, we don't join organizations anymore, Timothy P. Carney, who is a journalist and author of Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse, says, Rotary clubs, churches, and civic organizations allow us to be part of something. But Americans don't join as much as they used to, and those without college degrees are far less likely to do so. I think that alienation is behind so much working class struggle. A community offers peace of mind because we know others will be there to help, but the flip side is just as important. Having people rely on us gives us purpose. Life can't be fulfilling unless we feel needed. And under the heading, we're social animals forced into self-reliance. Amy Banks, MD, senior scholar at the International Center for Growth in Connection in Lexington, Massachusetts, and author of Four Ways to Click, Rewire Your Brain for Stronger, More Rewarding Relationships, says, everything from our immune system to our stress response is modulated by our relationships. But we're fixated on the idea that to be psychologically healthy, we have to stand on our own two feet. Although our brains contain mirror neurons that are designed to reflect others' emotional states, we're excessively concerned with setting boundaries and dismiss those who are sensitive to others' feelings as weak. If an adult regularly seeks comfort from other adults, she's labeled codependent. But if human brains self-regulated, solitary confinement wouldn't be torture. Instead of shaming people for neediness, we should be talking about how to bridge the space between us. That's the rich work of relationships. And on a sidebar, we have some statistics. 1 in 5, that's the number of Americans who say they rarely or never feel close to people. And 26% is increased risk of early death for those suffering from loneliness. Some more statistics. 15, the number of cigarettes one would need to smoke daily to equal the detrimental health effects of loneliness. And now we have a pie chart. America's response to how often do you feel that no one really knows you well? 41% say sometimes, 13% say always, 13% say never, and 33% say rarely. And here's the next contribution under the heading, Can You Hear Me Now? Podcaster Julia Bainbridge is proving that no one's alone in feeling lonely. Kat Turner spent 2.5 years as a movie star's personal chef, and though the gig required her to travel the world, it wasn't so glamorous. She says, quote, the hours are grueling and you're away from your friends and family for 3 months at a time. I felt like I lost a bit of my personality, end of quote. Trading in her preferred dinner dress for chef's clogs and a white jacket, she lost her sense of femininity, too. Because she wasn't allowed to disclose who she worked for, her life was strangely compartmentalized. Turner began to feel invisible. Though our culture tends to stigmatize loneliness as the plight of an awkward few, Turner's story and the other first-person accounts featured on The Lonely Hour, a podcast hosted by writer and editor Julia Bainbridge, paint a more complex portrait. One episode about a woman who ended her seemingly happy marriage examines the exile of being, quote, the leaver. Another features a musician whose loss of faith made him despondent. Bainbridge, 36, launched the podcast in 2016 after her friends began settling down with partners and she felt left behind. The show's not all doom and gloom. Indeed, the new season, its third, centers on the consoling effects of purposeful solitude. Says Bainbridge, quote, I wanted to bring to light how much loneliness exists in all of us and how it's part of the mixed bag of emotions involved in the human experience, end of quote. Memoirist Melissa Phoebos, who spoke on air about her absentee father and her affair with a married woman, says telling her story was cathartic. She says, quote, there are few experiences as powerful as articulating your vulnerability in the presence of another person. It's one of the reasons I became a writer, the urge to say aloud the things that scare me. It's a risk, but it's always worth it, end of quote. Perhaps the first rule of Loneliness Club is to talk about Loneliness Club. And now you'll need a pencil and paper for this one. Under the L Word, researcher Daniel Russell, PhD, debunks three myths about this delicate condition. Myth one, one is the loneliest number. Fact, Russell, professor of human development and family studies at Iowa State University, says, quote, loneliness isn't about being alone. It's about the nature of your relationships and your expectations, end of quote. You may have a dozen companions, but if that doesn't feel like enough or none of them gets you or you really want a romantic partner, you'll still have a hole in your soul. And the second of the three myths, older people are the loneliest. Fact, according to Russell, high school and college students tend to be the loneliest. Indeed, in the 2018 Cigna U.S. Loneliness Index, adults ages 18 to 22 reported the highest loneliness score. Russell says, quote, leaving home for college is a lonely situation for many young people, and social comparison might lead a student to perceive that her peers have more friends than she does, end of quote. Feeling as if everyone is hanging out without you leads to even more loneliness. And the final myth, loneliness is too abstract to measure. Fact. In 1978, Russell co-created the UCLA Loneliness Scale, a 20-question assessment that remains a standard for researchers studying loneliness. If you'd like to see where you stand, this adapted quiz has roughly the same accuracy rate. Answer each statement, then score your responses using the guide that follows. Here are the 10 questions. The first one, and the answers are never, rarely, sometimes, and always. So that's four answers. Never gets you a score of one, rarely gets you 2 points, sometimes gets you 3 points, and always gets you 4 points. Question number one, how often do you feel unhappy doing things alone? So that's never, rarely, sometimes, or always. Question number two, how often do you feel you have no one to talk to? Question number three, how often do you feel you cannot tolerate being so alone? And again, those answers are never, rarely, sometimes, and always. Question number four, how often do you feel as if no one understands you? Question number five, how often do you find yourself waiting for people to call or write? Question number six, how often do you feel completely alone? Question number seven, how often do you feel unable to reach out and communicate with those around you? Question number eight, how often do you feel starved for company? Question number nine, how often often do you feel that it is difficult for you to make friends? And question number 10, how often do you feel shut out and excluded by others? So with the answers being never, rarely, sometimes, and always, with never being 1 point and always being 4 points, let's look at the scoring. A total score is computed by adding up the response to each question. The average loneliness score on the measure is 20. A score of 25 or higher reflects a high level of loneliness. A score of 30 or higher reflects a very high level of loneliness. And the next article is called Give It the Office: How to Make 9-to-5 Come Alive. It behooves us all to create a friendlier workplace, says business psychologist Melanie A. Katzen, Ph.D., author of Connect First, 52 Simple Ways to Ignite Success, Meaning, and Joy at Work. She reminds us that everyone, from the intern to the big boss, has an inner eighth grader who craves acceptance. Katzman says, quote, "We all seek security, cherish praise, and feel shame. Everybody just wants a seat at the lunchroom table," end of quote. Katzman shares a few ideas for how we can be more inclusive, and there are three of them. Remember the little things. Say please and thank you. Show the temps where the coffee is. Learn the names of the security staff. These things sound so basic, but they're often forgotten. Some companies plan elaborate team-building events like paintball, when what an employee might find more meaningful is a genuine conversation about what she's working on. The second tip, open your eyes and ears. Though cubicles were meant to encourage interaction, in an effort to reclaim privacy, we tend to ignore one another, putting on headphones and avoiding eye contact. We may assume a new person's too busy for lunch. Maybe she'd love to be included, but pretends to be absorbed in work. Personal photos and other items are great conversation starters. Ask questions and listen to the answers instead of just waiting to give your prepared response. And finally, shine a light. Never pass up a chance to offer sincere praise. No one can ever get enough. Do a favor for a colleague. Share interesting research. Meaning is made one connection at a time. Even if morale is low, the best way to fight loneliness and negativity is not to bury yourself in a hole, but open up. That's true not just at the office, but in life. And in a sidebar, who has the loneliest job? The verdict may surprise you. According to a 2018 survey, lawyers take the title. San Francisco bankruptcy attorney Gina Cho says the pressures can be isolating and agitating. She's also co-author of The Anxious Lawyer. She says, quote, "There's no room for weakness. You're not allowed to say, 'I'm scared I'm going to lose that hearing,' which means my clients will lose their home." And in many specialties, criminal, divorce, family law, people in crisis are relying on you and you're bound to confidentiality, end of quote. Plus, the always-on-call culture leaves little time for self-care. However, since the National Task Force on Lawyer Well-Being was created in 2016, Cho says, quote, "There's been a push to talk about stress and anxiety in the field," end of quote. Cho teaches workshops where beleaguered legal eagles can learn mindfulness techniques and, just for a while, feel a little less alone. And now here's another statistic, 78%, the number of Americans who, when lonely, distract themselves with TV, computer, or video games. And under the heading, "The Future Looks Bright," flowers, puppies. Tanzil Shafiq, doctoral fellow and co-director of the Think and Do Tank Open Studio, asked students at the Melbourne School of Design in Australia to come up with creative responses to loneliness. A few of their ideas, and there are five of them here. Loneliness Express, train cars that use sensory experiences to promote commuter interaction. For instance, a gallery with paintings that can be seen only if they're simultaneously uncovered by two people. The next one, Can't Eat Alone Restaurant, where students farm and cook the meals as therapy, then dine at a communal table. The third one, Memento Mori, Gardening in a Cemetery, where instead of buying an arrangement, mourners can share their grief by growing flowers together. The fourth one, Super Social Supermarket, a big box store divided into smaller units designed to encourage togetherness. Circle around the stovetop and sample a new recipe. And finally, Puppy Society, an app that lets city dwellers co-own walking, petting, loving shelter dogs while they wait for forever homes. And now, under the heading The Wisdom of Crowds, a few ingenious organizations uniting to, and there are four things they're uniting to do. The first is soothe troubled minds. After a series of nationally disturbing events, the Sandy Hook shooting, the Trayvon Martin verdict, the Boston Marathon bombing, San Francisco psychotherapist Tracy Rubel wanted to give people a chance to just sit down and share. So in 2015, she and 27 colleagues created the first Sidewalk Talk event, setting up pairs of folding chairs on busy corners with signs that invited passers-by to stop for a one-on-one chat with a seasoned listener. Since then, the volunteer-led organization has spread to more than 50 cities in 14 countries, allowing over 12,000 people to open up about their work frustrations, love life, and anything else that comes up in the business of being human. Visit sidewalk-talk.org to find events or organize your own chapter. And here's another thing that's an ingenious organization is uniting to do, and that is bring generations together. The nonprofit Age to Age combats rural isolation in 18 northeastern Minnesota communities by connecting kids, teens, and seniors to work on shared projects. Since many elders don't have family nearby, the program is a much appreciated opportunity to bond with younger folk. To date, more than 21,000 youths and 13,000 older adults have created tech meetups where the mature set learns the ins and outs of iPads, tribal nation groups where a new generation learns to make traditional regalia and speak the Ojibwa language, and more. And the third thing that a few ingenious organizations are uniting to do is turn strangers into friends. When Ankit Shah was new to the Bay Area in 2013, the recent college grad asked his Facebook contacts if they had local friends who'd like to meet for tea. The adventure became a movement. Tea with Strangers has introduced people at cafes and other public spaces in 15 cities. Check out tea times at teawithstrangers.com. Sign up for one of five slots and be part of this initiative intended to, quote, make cities feel like neighborhoods, end of quote. And finally, an ingenious organization uniting to broaden cross-cultural understanding. Many refugee resettlement programs focus on the first 90 days after arrival, but in the months that follow, American life can be overwhelming and lonely. The Pittsburgh area program, Hello Neighbor, matches recent refugees with individuals, couples, or families who serve as both mentors to help with practical matters and friends to share the fun stuff like sightseeing and cooking. One more item on this page, suburban renewal. Picket fences are so over. Welcome to more neighborly neighborhoods. Though acres of subdivisions once represented the American dream, architect Ellen Dunham Jones, a leader in suburban redevelopment, is seeing a growing desire for environments that foster more connection. Quote, "We've held up privacy as the supreme goal, but I think we're now asking, is this all it's cracked up to be?" End of quote. But for the many baby boomers who are empty nesters rattling around in a big detached house, it's left them with a distinct feeling of detachment. Dunham Jones says, quote, they want to live in places where they can walk to shops and doctors and volunteer opportunities, end of quote. Dunham Jones, who is a proponent of retrofitting dying shopping malls into mixed-use town centers, says a solution that's already being implemented around the country. She says, quote, I think more millennials will move to the suburbs, but I predict we'll see cottage courts, already a popular trend, where one or two house blocks will instead have 6 to 10 smaller houses grouped around a single yard. That generation tends to like sharing, and they'll want to bring that idea with them, end of quote. Sounds like home sweet home. And now we'll leave the topic of loneliness. And still in the special features section this month, now we're going to head to The Beautiful One. On March 2016, book editor Chris Jackson signed a deal to publish Prince's memoir. A month later, Prince was dead. But on October 29th, The Beautiful Ones, a remarkable chronicle of the making of an artist, told through words, lyrics, drawings, photos, and other ephemera, will be released. Here Jackson narrates his 3-year journey of creation and collaboration. And this is against a picture. It says, Prince had this Yamaha C7X piano painted purple and unveiled it at a Paisley Park dance party in 2016. And it is a large grand piano. And it's shown in a studio, and it's sitting on top of an oriental rug. In December 2015, Susan Camel, Random House's late publisher, poked her head into my office to say she'd received a call from the literary agent, Esther Newberg. Newberg's client, Prince, wanted to write a book. Were we interested? I've been a diehard Prince fan since age 12. I grew up in a conservative religious family. When I was a kid in New York in the 80s, Prince was exactly the sort of character my parents desperately wanted me to steer clear of, which only made me more curious. The first songs of his I heard were funky and frankly sexual. Even a cloistered kid like me got the point. Do me, baby. I want to be your lover. Little Red Corvette. Then came Purple Rain, which felt like a world inside my Walkman. The album was operatic, raunchy, an adventure and escape. From then on, I knew every word of every Prince song, plus every grunt and ad lib. Even as my musical tastes changed, it was Prince who rocked with me from the Harlem streets where I lived to the Upper East Side school I attended. Time has not cooled my Prince passion. I've been known to sing and crawl my way across the karaoke bar floor in a pretty credible reenactment of When Doves Cry. So yes, I was interested. There had been rumors of Prince book projects for years, and nothing had come to pass. So at first, I tempered my excitement. Then, along with the two other editors vying for the acquisition, I got invited to Paisley Park outside Minneapolis to meet Prince in person. I no longer cared how much of a long shot it was. If Prince was going to write a memoir, I wanted to publish it. I'd always envisioned Paisley Park as a Willy Wonka wonderland, so when we pulled up on a January afternoon in 2016, it came as a shock that from the outside there was nothing Paisley or park about it. The giant white structure could have been an office complex. Trevor, a close Prince aide, came out to advise us to put away our phones as Prince didn't care for them and to be careful about our language. Nothing racy could be said now that Prince was a Jehovah's Witness. I was nervous. When I told people I was meeting Prince, they'd come back to me with all kinds of warnings like, don't look him in the eye, he hates that. I figured those were urban legends, but who knew? The cavernous entryway was filled with a strong fragrance, which I soon realized came from the candles burning everywhere, including along the narrow catwalks we followed to the meeting room, the only illumination in the building. We passed the tricked-out motorcycle, Prince Road, in purple rain. Climbing stairs, we encountered a cage filled with doves. We entered a dim hallway, at the end of which was a lone light. There, in silhouette, stood Prince. The room in which he waited contained a conference table and a piano. There was a painting of a piano on the ceiling. Prince greeted us warmly. He was shorter than I expected, with a blooming afro. As we shook hands, he looked me in the eye and said, "I think I know you from somewhere. I've seen you before." I said something stupid like, "I think I've seen you before, too." It was unprecedented in my experience to be meeting a prospective author with the competition present and, in our own ways, each of us trying to stand out. One of the editors, in the fog of the moment, brought up the rumor that the design of the 1999 album was meant to represent 666 upside down. Prince let that sit in the air for a minute, and the energy shifted in the room. He said, "No," dismissively, but I also felt a hint of frustration. I sensed this was just the sort of thing that drove him crazy. He played a recording of a Larry Graham bass line for us. It was electric to see how turned on by music he still was. He talked about his admiration for Bruce Springsteen as a band leader, the way he could slightly gesture to or look at a band member, like they were instruments he was playing. Prince discovered I'd worked on a book with Jay-Z and said Jay-Z was doing something special with his streaming service by giving artists better deals and representing their music with higher fidelity. But he rolled his eyes. Of course they're trying to put him out of business. Racism and injustice in the music industry were so real for him, and he spoke as passionately about that, about control and freedom, as he did about music itself. But sometimes he would hint at moving in a more gossipy direction. "Oh, I got Rick James stories," he teased, "but those are for the book." The mischievous look that popped up from time to time when he started to name names and offer opinions made me excited for what tales might find their way into the memoir. The next day I flew back to New York and put together an offer. Now Prince would have to decide which editor to work with on what he'd already titled The Beautiful Ones. A couple of weeks later, I got the word that he'd picked me. Next, he chose a writing partner, Paris Review editor Dan Pippenbring. It was surreal. I was excited, yet I felt it could fall apart at any moment. The reality didn't start to sink in until the morning I was in the corner bodega near my apartment in Brooklyn and an unidentified number came up on my cell phone. "Hello, Christopher," said Prince. I'll always remember the way he enunciated my name, the elegant musicality of it. On March 18, 2016, Prince came to New York and performed at a private concert in Chelsea, where he jubilantly announced that he'd agreed to write and publish his memoir. Over the next weeks, Dan sent me notes about the material Prince was writing that were full of sense details and the weave of memory, the look of his mother's eyes, the sound of his father's piano, along with observations about music that were singularly Prince, about funk, about slow jams, and making love, with that same sly and intense humor you got in his songs. I couldn't wait for more. On April 21st, I was returning from lunch when, out of the blue, a dazed-looking stranger approached me on 8th Avenue near my office and said, "Prince died. I can't believe it." "What?" At first, I didn't think it could be true. I looked down at my cell, which was blowing up with alerts and emails. I went back to my desk and tried to process that the gentle, welcoming, quirky, brilliant man I'd just begun to get to know, so incredibly alive, was gone. As the news began to sink in, Dan and I spoke with the book's agents, Esther and her colleague, Dan Kirshen. Julie Grau, a crucial partner on the project and my boss at the time, was on the line too. We agreed that Prince's fans should read what was on his mind before he died, and his estate was willing to let us go forward with the book. But Prince had been a famously demanding artist, and his death made the challenge of living up to his vision even more difficult, so we'd need to stretch to find a level of creative freedom and excellence that matched his own. We were getting the chance to fulfill one of his last wishes, but to do so, we'd have to return to Paisley Park. Walking in this time was vastly different. A group of Midwestern bankers, now overseeing the state, was there to greet us. There were no burning candles, no fragrant scent. Electric lights were blazing. The air felt stagnant, as if the place was in mourning. We wandered from room to room, inspecting murals, guitars, pianos, records, costumes. On the second level, we stumbled into a room containing a bed, a couch, and a stereo. Record albums were stacked nearby. A rainbow was painted on one wall, and in large letters, the words, "Everything you think is true." We went downstairs to the vault, which I'd imagined as a mythical treasure trove, but which turned out to be a well-lit, temperature-controlled storage room. It had to be broken into after Prince's death. I'd heard that this had required the intervention of an international security firm, because Prince himself had long forgotten the passcode, but by the time we got there, we were able to get in without trouble. We approached through an anteroom, where we felt Prince's presence acutely. At the entrance were items that seemed curated to represent his life. Photos and honors, paintings of him by fans and artists. Inside the vault was a huge steel cabinet, which we opened. It was filled with recording files, tapes, a series of selfies taken by a young Prince, a snapshot of Prince and his father. We began to feel a sense of discovery, as though Prince himself were leading us through his inner sanctum. There in the now disheveled Paisley Park was the Prince I'd listened to all my life, but also the man himself, closing his eyes in ecstasy as he listened to his favorite Larry Graham bass line, laughing hysterically at a joke no one understood but him, sharing with us family photos, writings, pieces of art. All of that we tried to get into the book, that brilliant spark that shone before he died, that we read on his handwritten pages and felt in the objects he handled. We hope the book carries that spark, the same way all of us who worked on it will carry it with us always. And some of the items pictured here include a close-up just above the keyboard of this purple piano with the love symbol number 2, which he trademarked and used as his name in the 1990s. There's a picture of his 6th grade report card in which his grades are pretty mediocre. Ms. Hoban's notes about when he should be more prepared for class and bring his assignments, etc., are noted for history. And then there is a painting by St. Louis artist Sababi Bayok that hangs in the piano room at Paisley Park. And it's a very stylized picture of African-American artists with a horn and a guitar and a bass. And then there's a series of pictures with Prince and his guitarist, Des Dickerson, from the 1980s. And then there's a picture of Prince in bed with his guitar from 1978. And finally, a fedora that remains on a piano, exactly where Prince placed it. As we wrap up this first installment for November, let's read a couple of answers to this month's question. Who or what are you most grateful for this year? Ann Bennett DeBretti of Jupiter, Florida says, "My son Nate is nonverbal and has autism. We live a great distance from his day program, and its transportation service is expensive. My husband and I were unsure we could afford it, but we had no alternative. At the end of an annual girlfriend's weekend, my best friend Sally handed me an envelope. She had given me a check for $1,800, the exact amount of the transportation cost for the next 4 months. This was a blessing from my BFF, who gave from her heart. I treasure our friendship of 45 years and feel very grateful to have her as a big part of my life." Antonia Albany of Santa Rosa, California says, my three-legged cat, Callie. She is a best friend who doesn't judge or ridicule. She is always with me, listening, cuddling, soothing, and reminding me of what's important in life. Her self-confidence never wavers, and when she flops, she bounces back quickly, head held high. She is a great role model. Susan Branscom of Cincinnati says, 2 years ago, I lost 68 pounds, and I've kept the weight off through a healthy food plan and exercise. After two knee replacements and two hip replacements in the last 5 years, I was ready for a challenge. I hiked the Grand Canyon this summer, 35 miles in 5 days. Now I'm more grateful for my health, my endurance, and my stamina. Paulette Grady of Washington, D.C. says, I am most grateful for having survived another year of breast cancer. It's been 18 years, and I've undergone two mastectomies and reconstruction surgery. I'm also thankful for my acting coach, who stretches me to go forth and bring it. Marissa Giuliani of East Greenwich, Rhode Island says, my girls of summer tribe. We met through our mutual love of baseball. In June, we traveled to England to watch the Boston Red Sox, our favorite team, play at London Stadium. It was a dream trip that took over a year to plan. I love these ladies unconditionally. And Luke Berthlet of Ontario says, my three-year-old nephew. Everything is amazing and wonderful through his eyes. An airplane in the sky, a butterfly flapping its wings, an animated movie, peanut butter. He looks at the world in awe, and I love that. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.